The environs of the monastery were full of animation. Country people could be seen moving hither and thither, leading yaks or horses loaded with wood, meat, or grain. Petty chiefs rode amongst them giving orders with an important and busy mien. Troopers also ran to and fro, in and out of the gate of the Gompa. From the distant spot from which I witnessed this agitation, the lamasery with its unwritten mud houses seemed an anthill occupied by diligently working insects. The fugitive official had taken refuge at Sung Zong, and wherever a chief stays, the inhabitants of the region are not only compelled to feed him, his retainers, servants and beasts, but also to offer him daily presents. This explained the procession of poor ants going to fill the storerooms of the Ponpoa's household. The prophecy with which I had surprised and gratified the conspirators in the forest cabin, was nearing its fulfillment. Several great lamas had intervened as peacemakers between the offended governor and the braves of Chos Zong. One of them had passed by us while we were eating, seated near a stream. Looking at the pretty procession of riders clad in gold brocade and bright yellow satin, with their darkered travelling coats and zenza, we had entirely forgotten that humble folk such as ourselves ought at least to stand up to show our respect. The great lama, who was a young man, did not appear offended, and smiled at his less fortunate brother in the order, who had become indescribably ragged by this time. The Tibetan servants, always more arrogant than their masters, looked at us angrily. But the Tulku had smiled and they had to refrain from beating us, as they would have enjoyed doing. Yongdan remained abput 3 hours at the Gompa. He met some nice obliging troopers who gave him goods in addition to the provisions he had purchased, such as a liberal amount of bread, and dried apricots. Such kind treatment gave him no chance of shunning the long chat which Tibetans enjoy much, or of refusing to drink the tea so cordially offered. Thus time passed quickly, and rather pleasantly, for my companion, but rather dully for me, who remained seated with our a wild and barren spot swept by a piercingly cold wind. For company I had first a few children minding cattle, who came to sit near me. I learned a few things worth knowing from their candid mouths. After them came a well-todo traveller, accompanied by several servants. He stopped to ask for whom I was waiting, as he saw my two loads and so understood that I had a companion. I told him that my son, a Jalong, had gone to the monastery. This looked quite respectable, and the man dismounted to ask me more questions about my native land and other topics. At that time I had again adopted a new mother country, the Farofngari. The traveller had only heard about it, but he had once been to Shigatse, the capital of the Tsang province. As I had stayed there some years before, I was quite at ease in discussing it, and the man having seated himself on the ground, we had a pleasant chat together, in which the servants joined. He was coming from the Kongbu province and carried some cakes of dried molasses, of which he gave me two. When the Lama returned proudly with his provisions, and boasted of the presents he had received, I enjoyed puzzling him with my two sugar cakes, which I said that a Lamo, goddess, had given me. The country which we entered soon after leaving Sung Zong, must without doubt be admirable in all seasons, but winter had now transformed it into a bewitching fairyland. For miles we proceeded under cover of gloomy, silent, and mysterious forests. Then, an unexpected clearing suddenly revealed, behind the dark line of tall fir trees, extraordinary landscapes of shining snow-clad mountains, towering high in the blue sky, frozen torrents and glittering waterfalls hanging like gigantic and immaculate curtains from the rugged rocks. We looked at them, speechless and enraptured, wondering if we had not reached the confines of the human world and were confronted with the abode of some genii. But as we continued on our way, the forest again surrounded us, and the vision disappeared. Yet tomorrow or the day after a new fantastic apparition would rise before us in the same instantaneous way. I tarried long in that beautiful region, making long deviations from the direct road, walking leisurely during the day, sleeping generally in the open, at the foot of a tree or in a cave when lucky enough to discover one on my road at the time of camping. But the beauty of nature was not the only object of interest offered by Poyu. We did not always spend the night in the forest, on reaching hamlets, isolated farms, or monasteries, we often begged hospitality. Sometimes it happened that we were forbidden to enter. More than once we had to defend ourselves against dogs left loose to keep us away, and with utmost gravity we sometimes discussed the degree of ferocity of the canine watchers of the different places we passed. We had been given enough opportunities to make a study of it. Other selfish people answered our request by saying that there was a sick person in the house, and this was equivalent to a strict prohibition to approach it, a superstition, having nothing to do with the desire to avoid the propagation of diseases, is at the bottom of this custom. Tibetans, as I have already mentioned, never believe that any illness or accident has a natural cause. These are considered as the work of evil spirits, which are hunting for the vital principles of the beings to enslave them or feed upon them. A strong and healthy person is supposed to be more difficult to catch and kill than one already debilitated by sickness, just as a swift deer is a harder match for the hunter than a lame or already wounded one. Now, Tibetans suspect all travelers coming from afar of being accompanied by devils, so that, if introduced in the house where a man is ailing, undesirable and invisible visitors could enter it in their train. Needless to say, the cunning Tibetans often take advantage of this superstition to shut their doors even when all the inmates enjoy perfect health. I once terribly frightened a woman who used this excuse to send us away. Before she closed the blinds of her only window, I had had time to peep inside and to see that no one was lying down. Then, assuming an inspired air, I exposed her lie and prophesied that, as she had falsely told saintly pilgrims that one of her family was ill, real sickness would indeed come on her house. This declaration was accompanied by brief choreographic exercises in which I shook the lap of my large dress as if I were liberating a host of devils who had been sheltered in it. The comedy ended with a present of butter which the selfish housewife, who was now weeping, offered us. She also begged us to spend the night under her roof, but we refused. Still, to console her, Yongdan blessed the small farm from outside to charm away the sickness I had foreseen. It may be that my performance has benefited, in the course of time, some tired and hungry Ajopa to whom the woman has not dared to refuse hospitality. But all doors were not closed to us. Far from it. This gave me most interesting opportunities of witnessing from the inside, as we had done along the upper Salween Valley, the life and customs of the inhabitants. Familiar talks allowed me to study their peculiar mentality, their views and beliefs. I heard witty stories and terrifying legends. Thanks to the time I had allowed for slow progress and wandering at random, I was also quite unexpectedly favored with two unforgettable meetings, most valuable for my observations on Tibetan mysticism. However, for the present, I must confine myself to the brief outline of my adventures of travel, putting aside the more special topics which will find their place elsewhere. The first important place we reached after Sungzong was called Dashin. It is the seat of a large monastery. The day before we arrived there, we met on the road two villagers, husband and wife, who had bought a cow somewhere and were leading it to their house at Dashin. As was nearly always the case when coming in touch with people, Yongdan was requested to make mows about some land business. We walked several hours with the pair, and as we stopped to drink tea, they went on ahead, promising a hearty welcome in their home. However, toward the end of the afternoon, while crossing a village, we saw the cow tied before a door, and its owner shouted at us from the threshold, "Ago slowly. We will join you soon." But evening came and the peasants did not appear. We understood they were spending the night at their friend's house. It was too late to beg hospitality at the first village we reached. People were certainly asleep and would not open their doors. The incident did not trouble us in the least, for by that time we had become quite accustomed to remaining at night in the open. We found a pit in the forest and lay in it with our baggage, and, as patches of snow were to be seen here and there, we spread our tent over us in the old way. The sky generously came to our assistance and sprinkled real snow on our sham snow during our sleep. We were therefore really well hidden, and kept warm all the night. The next day, After having passed a village, we stopped to take our breakfast on the bank of a wide mountain stream. We were just finishing when the couple appeared with their cow. They explained that they had been delayed and had slept at their friend's house, and pressed us to proceed with them to their house. We went together, and very likely out of the desire to get payment of their hospitality beforehand, they asked Yongdan to make mows again, about various affairs, even while walking. One of the mows concerned the health of a man very seriously ill, would he still be alive, or not, when the two villagers reached Dashin. Although he was, as a rule, a seer full of prudence, Yongdan was bored by the importunity of the peasants, and said bluntly, "He is dead." I could not tell whether the news brought them sorrow or pleasure. We did not know if they were the anxious heirs of the supposed departed one, or his loving relatives. At any rate, they spoke together in a low tone, and then kept silent. About half an hour later, a man passed us, coming from Dashin. Our companions at once asked about the fate of the sufferer. "He is much better," was the answer. The prestige of the Lama fell immediately, and when the golden roof of the Dashin monastery emerged from the forest, those who were to be our hosts went their way without taking any more notice of us. We did not attempt to follow them or try in any way to claim the hospitality which they had promised us. We really cared very little for it. It was indeed a happy time in my life when the many nights spent in the open had freed me from concern about shelter and the like. The place where we had been abandoned was a pretty one, half smiling, half austere. The lamas of Dashin had evidently felt, as I did, the peculiar beauty of the spot, for they had built several tsemkanga there, high above the road, against a rocky diff. The small white houses of the Riddhasis appeared as if hung on the black rock, while a few daring fir trees, which had taken root in some crevices, framed the whole dust of ascetic dwellings. These houses are called tsavkang because the recluses remain isolated behind their closed doors as if a barrier had been erected around them, to be crossed by no one. Any lama who is above the common lot is expected to spend, at least once in his life, a period of a little over 3 years in such a retreat, and, in addition, 1 month or more yearly. These periods of retreat are called tsam, and the recluse tsampa. There are many varieties of tsami more or less severe as to the strictness and length of the reclusion. Between the lama, who merely shuts himself in a tsamkang or even in his own apartment, and who, although he does not receive visitors, sees freely a number of attendants who wait upon him, and the one who dwells in complete darkness and silence, receiving his food through a double wicket, there exist many degrees. Besides tsamkangs, there exist in Tibet ritesi, which are a more remote kind of hermitage, to which the still stricter ascetics resort. Details about them cannot be given in the present book. I must leave them for a future publication. Indeed, this world of the Tibetan mystics is a mystery in the mystery of Tibet, a strange wonder in a wonderland country. Very possibly Tibet will soon cease to be forbidden ground, but one may doubt if the secret of its tsamkang and ritesi, the aims of their dwellers and the results they achieve, will ever be disclosed to the many. I sat in the meadow near a huge erratic boulder, and enjoyed weaving fancies about the men hidden from me behind the white walls of their miniature dwellings. During this time a large party of Neskorpas passed me. They had visited Lhasa on a pilgrimage, and were on their way to their homes in the new valley. Yongdan and I endeavored to get information about the road and the country they had crossed, but we got very few interesting details. These poor villagers or members of the low clergy do not take the least interest in what they see on their way. They walk like cattle, without even noticing the road which they follow. Most of them are certainly not bright-minded, but it may be said in their defense that the fatigue caused by the long daily tramps with a heavy load on the back and scanty food tends to benumb the mental faculties. I have experienced ills myself and once had to struggle with all my might against a kind of overpowering dullness, which would have made me walk in as bovine a fashion as these poor pilgrims. On nearing the monastery I remarked, standing at some distance, the man and the woman whom we had met on the road. They looked at us shyly, though intently. "They are not bad fellows, after all," I said, pointing them out to Yongdan. I am certain that they repent having abandoned us, and now wish to keep their promise. The Lama cast a glance at the couple. The sick man has died, he declared.
How do you know?
I asked, with astonishment. It is not difficult to understand, replied my companion. Have you not noticed how humble their attitude is and how different from their manner on the road? They fear to have offended a great prophet, and dread the evil consequences of their rudeness. That means that they have found the man dead on their arrival. Perhaps this pessimistic opinion was, after all, justified. I never knew. Yongdan walked with a dignified gait toward the monastery, without giving as much as a glance at the anguished bear, and I sat on the stones bordering the avenue which passed along the river below the Gompa. Although it was not built on a summit, the deep river winding at its feet and the rocky headland which confronts it from across the green water, surround the lamasery with a pretty and romantic landscape to which the gilded dome, emerging above the old walls of the enclosure, adds a peculiar character. Behind the monastery, a wide cultivated valley opens out. A track follows it, and leads to southern Tibet, across several passes. This trail has branches, some of which reach the borders of India in Assam, on the banks of the Brahmaputra, while others take the traveler to China or to Burma. On the opposite shore of the Polung Tsangpo, a short distance from Dashin, yet another track runs northward through the hills, touching the main road from Kiamdo to Jhalsa. This gives access to several roads leading to the land of grass, to Jakiendo, the market town situated on the route of the tea caravans. Then, proceeding still farther north, one can reach the great Sino-Tibetan markets of Sining and Dangkar, in Kansu. Continuing the journey, one arrives in Mongolia. All the northern part of this track, beyond the Kiamdo Road, is familiar to me. In any other country, a place situated in such a favorable geographical location would have become an important center. The divers' roads which converge there would have been duly improved, if not as cart roads, at least as good mule paths. But in Tibet no one gives a thought to such questions, and Dashin is but a village. As I was seated by the side of the river, several people passed, and amongst them were some women going to cut wood in the forest which we had crossed on our way. They stopped to question me. I told them I was waiting for my son, who had gone to the monastery, and we enjoyed a short chat together. Yongdan remained very long at the Gompa. He had by chance met a monk coming from the same land where his great-grandfather had been a red-capped married lama of rank. He knew a number of people there, if not all personally, at least by name, and although he had not heard about them for years, he satisfied the eager curiosity of his brother in the order and gave him news of everybody and of everything. Such a lucky meeting could not pass in Tibet without eating and drinking. While her son enjoyed the clerical company behind the wall where women were forbidden, the old mother, after the sun had set, began to feel rather cold, seated on the stones telling her beads. Women are only allowed to enter the monasteries of the Yellow Cap sect on certain religious festival days, and even then must retire outside of the walls after sunset. My situation at Kambum was quite exceptional. I never heard of a woman to whom a house had been granted there. The women returned, each one carrying a load of wood. They were most astonished to see me still in the same place. This gave them the opportunity for another chat, and the eldest one kindly invited me to her house for the night, explaining to me minutely where it was situated. They then went away, but had only gone a few steps when Yongdan appeared, accompanied by a young novice lama. Both were loaded with provisions, and we were invited to pass the night somewhere in the village. But I preferred to go with the good woman with whom I hated a talk, and so it was she whom we followed. The master of the house into which we were shown, although only a villager, was remarkably intelligent. He had traveled much and had lived long at Lhasa. We took great pleasure in listening to him, though we were rather afraid that he might penetrate my disguise. So I performed all the menial work, leaving the lama seated on the carpet that had been spread for him near the fire in an entrance room, for we were not invited to enter the family kitchen. I noticed, since my arrival in the Po country, that the inhabitants of that region were rather particular in that respect. In the New Valley, and often in that of the Jiamo New Chu, we were allowed to sleep with the people of the house in the kitchen, but the Papas seemed decidedly against it. We started at daybreak. The weather was cold and the wind blew hard, sweeping along the large open valley toward the south, but we soon entered the forest again, and felt warmer. The Po Valley, from its source, at the foot of the range which we had crossed, down to the Brahmaputra, offers a variety of climates. We had found it amongst deep snows, and now it was flowing between barley fields, in January. The virgin soil of the valley seems to be very fertile. Attracted by the hope of better harvests, a number of new settlers coming from the adjacent Pitneys had cleared small parts of the forest, and built rustic farms of logs, very like Russian izbas. The floor trees which sometimes surround them add to this likeness, and give a decidedly Russian or Siberian aspect to the landscape. Many of these primitive homes are no more than cabins, of which some are not larger than 80 to 100 feet square. In one of these we found an idyllic pair of lovers. Youth had long since passed for both, though they were not yet old. The man had a wen on his neck, and his spouse herself was no beauty. In the hut, together with the couple, slept a cow, her suckling calf, two other youngsters of the same species, and a few baby black pigs. A true nursery of four-footed young brothers, having, alas, no attentive nurse to lead the little ones outside when their needs required open air. In these surroundings we heard a most touching love story, though of the kind Western moralists call sinful. For the housewife of the Noah's Ark had been mistress of another, better and larger dwelling, and had run away into the wilds, penniless, with a penniless Romeo. They had no children, and, a thing rare in Tibet, did not desire any. Their love for each other, though of long standing, filled their hearts to the brim. These poor people treated us well. We shared a turnip soup with them, and they then insisted on presenting us with sonit sampa to eat on the road. Yongdan was requested to make mos. He ended cleverly enough by saying that in order to please the Lu they ought to clean their house carefully, and to offer milk to the snail's deities. We four then lay down to sleep, our hosts on one side of the hearth, Yongdan and I on the other side, the cow near the door, the calves at our feet, and the lively little pigs running to and fro over us, as there was not much room left for them in the hut. When we heard the lovers snoring, Yongdan muttered in my ear, "I will put 5 rupees in a pot on the shelf. They will find them when they clean the house and will think that Dallas have brought them." It was a wonderful joke, but I advised him to give them Indian rupees. This was a little precaution for safety's sake. Had we been suspected of being the donors, T:/'s rupees would have proved almost certainly that we had gone from Lhasa, where these coins are available, to eastern Tibet, and were on our way back home. As the Indian money was in a separate bag, even in the dark it was easy to get at it. I should like to have been able to witness the finding of the 5 rupees. How great an opinion the two good people must have formed of the holy, learned Lama whose blessing had attracted to them the bounty of the Lhas. But as there are countless popular stories about Lhas wandering about in a human shape, perhaps our hosts would believe that we were ourselves Lhas in disguise. That visit of gods to faithful lovers reminded me of the fable of Philemon and Baucis, and I related it to my companion. New Year in the Po Yule, as well as in some parts of Kham, docs not come at the same date as at Lhasa, where people follow the Chinese calendar. This peculiarity caused us to arrive at Shoa, the humble capital of Pomt, on the very day of the Pippa's New Year. The king was at Lhasa with his wife, a sister of the present general-in-chief of the Tibetan army. We already knew this before reaching Shoa, but a servant of the palace whom we met on the road repeated it to us. Nevertheless, as everybody would rejoice and be merry on that day, we wanted to get our own little private fun and the profit thereof. So we boldly began a loud recitation at the gate of the royal dwelling. Blessings on each and all flowed freely from our eloquent lips. I doubt that even in that country of noisy beggars they have often seen our equals. Heads appeared at the windows, people swarmed down the steep staircases. They were bewildered, bewitched. Our triumph made us bold, and our boldness increased the strength of Yongdana's deep voice, trained in the choir in the lamasery. The dogs which had begun to bark were finally silenced, and disappeared as if terrorized, or fled to the farthest corners of the courtyard. I guess that, however uncommon our performance may have been, the men themselves must have felt anxious to see the end of it, for servants brought out a pot of spirits, tea, and sampa, and we were invited to sit down in the courtyard and feast. We declined the offer of chang, spirits, saying that as Buddhists we never drank any. This increased the esteem of the palace stewards still further, and they showed it by ordering dried meat to be placed before us. But when we again declared that as Buddhists we respected the life of all things and did not approve of the slaughter of animals, a view which not necessarily meant vegetarianism, and that, above all, we would not begin the year with a cruel action, their admiration became extreme. Regarding the flesh diet, it is against the spirit of Buddhism, though one cannot find in the scriptures a text which forbids it expressly, as is the case with intoxicating beverages, but the restrictions mentioned in connection with the partaking of flesh amount to a formal prohibition, for there is no way to avoid transgressing them. A Buddhist is allowed to eat meat under the following restrictions: he must not have killed the beast himself, he must not have ordered anyone else to kill it. It must not have been killed by somebody with the intention of supplying it to him, he must not suspect that the animal has been killed. If the two first restrictions may be easily turned, the third one is already a trifle more embarrassing, but some get around it by saying that the butchers slaughter for the public at large and not to supply the requirements of any particular person. As for the fourth, it must be difficult indeed to eat a piece of meat without suspecting that the animal from which it has been taken had been killed. But in all countries there are able sophists, the band of jovial monks, in the medieval tales, who in Lent baptized a chicken carp so as to eat it lawfully, is a case in point. And the subtleties of the Oriental mind can easily provide many arguments in favor of gluttony. As I am on that subject, I should like to point out a striking difference between Lamaism and the self-styled primitive orthodox Buddhism of the Southern School. The discussion, being connected with Tibetan custom, is not out of place. Meat eaters amongst the Buddhists of Ceylon, Burma and Siam, try, as I have said, to justify their flesh diet by various sophistic interpretations of the above-mentioned restrictions. When they belong to the religious order, they declare also that they are not allowed to choose the food begged by them, and must accept whatever they get from charitable people. This is altogether wrong. The genuine round of the bhikshusavya has become nowadays a mere pretense, a ceremonial walk to appointed places to fetch a meal specially cooked for the monks. Moreover, they would not fail to withdraw if bad, dirty, or unhealthy food was poured into the ritualistic bowls they carry themselves, or into the various vessels that are brought behind them by their attendant boys. In Tibet, the situation is quite different. Certainly, many are those who repeat, "I have not killed the animal myself," but they do it with complete skepticism as to the value of the excuse. In fact, there is not one Tibetan who is not convinced that eating flesh is more or less wrong. The usual practice of the lamas, I do not say the tupas, or common clergy, is to abstain from animal food on the 8th, 15th, and 30th days of the moon, and during the whole of the first month of the year, thus showing their regard for the right way of living which they have not the strength to follow continually. Men and women, either a lay or in the order, who are strict vegetarians, who feed on white diet, as it is called in Tibetan, are not exceedingly rare in Tibet, and they are greatly praised for it. The tantric sects hold special views about killing. These are interesting in many respects, but it would take too much space to examine them here. They will find place, in due course, in a study on the philosophic and mystic doctrines of Tibet. However, before continuing our story, I must add that, although at first sight the habit of eating meat causes the premature death of many animals and appears more important than spirit drinking or than the actual fact of being drunk, Tibetans are justified in their opinion that sobriety is the most important factor in mental and spiritual progress, A sinner who knows what may cometh his bad actions is likely to change his ways, but the drunkard is helpless, owing to the collapse of his reasoning faculty.